Welcome to a discussion of today's hottest trend in personnel management. I'm sure our panelists will have other things to say about it as well. Before I get further, let me tell you who I am. I am Pepper Crutcher. I'm the chairman of the Labor and Employment Practice Group, and I am directed to give you two pieces of preliminary information. One, if you're not eating, if you're not drinking, and you're not speaking, you should be wearing one of these lovely masks that are available over there on the other side of the hall by the sackful. Thank you very much. If you're here for CLE, as I am, you should have this card. And on this card, there is a QR code, which if you hover over it with your smartphone, will take you to a link, which will enable you to sign in, as every one of you must, at the start of every day, not just the start of the convention, at the start of every day. And some of you, depending on your state, may have to sign out at the end of the day, too, in order to get your CLE credit. I have the honor to introduce our moderator today, Judge Paul B. Mady of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Judge Mady was appointed by President Trump on March 8, 2019, before his judicial service. He was a partner at Lowenstein Sandler in New Jersey, where he practiced complex commercial litigation and criminal defense. Earlier, Judge Mady was a senior vice president, general counsel, and secretary for University Hospital in Newark, an academic medical center and teaching hospital. He also served as the Deputy General Counsel to Governor Chris Christie and as an Assistant United States Attorney in the District of New Jersey, where he was awarded the Justice Department's Director's Award for Superior Performance. Judge Mady.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Pepper, on behalf of the entire panel, thanks for that kind introduction. Pepper set himself up for toughest of challenges by opening with a joke. I thought it succeeded, you know, but I'm a poor judge of humor being a judge, so, you know.
When you die at the palace, you really die.
There you go. There you go. And thanks to everyone at the Federalist Society, including Dean Reuter, of course, for this extraordinary set of conversations. It's such a delight to be back with everyone, friends new and old, in person at this convention. It's always a pleasure to moderate one of these discussions, and I was particularly delighted to join this particular conversation as it touches upon an issue of personal interest to me, an area at the intersection of policy and precedent, of social norms and statutes, of cases, controversies, and careers. I speak, of course, of the age-old struggle between corporate HR and in-house counsel. Anyone who has ever worked inside a business or advised a corporation know well what I mean. In my time as a general counsel and in my work as a lawyer, it was always a safe bet that the employment matters meant extra hours on the timesheet and extra Advil on the way home, as I think it should be. As the introduction to this session notes, the American workplace, well, it scarcely resembles the one that I joined some 25 years back. Nearly every expectation once thought fundamental to work has given way to new thinking, opening up opportunity, but ushering in well-founded concern. Concern about how to create working environments, the nature of the firm itself, and who should lead the charge for change. Law, in my opinion, is the predictable standard that allows for steady and sure organization. Policy, well, it's the engine of innovation, the catalyst for tomorrow. It's HR versus legal all over the country in a fight that can only have one winner, say some. Or perhaps new solutions or even old solutions can chart a course that balances our commitment to the rule of law with our commitment to the betterment of America's economy. We are fortunate to have three experienced voices on today's panel to help us explore these issues, beginning with Sharon Gustafson, the immediate past General Counsel of the United States Equal Opportunity Commission, where she helped lead the enforcement of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. Graduate of the Georgetown Law Center, Sharon is an experienced litigator and counselor representing employers and employees in federal and state workplace matters. We'll begin today with Sharon's remarks and then continue through the panel. Sharon.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here today. For 30 years, I have been an employment lawyer, representing both employers and employees in the workplace. I have been watching employers operating under civil rights laws for a long time. I've been asked to talk about the diversity, equity, and inclusion agenda that is currently taking HR departments by storm. Reading up on DEI in the workplace, one would get the impression that the DEI agenda is fueled by employer desire to comply with a legal obligation. I can summarize very briefly what the federal employment civil rights statutes say about diversity, equity, and inclusion. Nothing. When I was at the EEOC, I saw eyes widen and jaws drop just a bit when I noted that none of these words appear in the statutes that the EEOC enforces. Instead, Title VII and related employment statutes forbid discrimination based on race, sex, religion, color, national origin, age, and disability. Far from commanding diversity, equity, or inclusion, Title VII expressly states that it does not require affirmative action where employees of a protected group are underrepresented in the workplace. In fact, Title VII expressly forbids an employer from being motivated, even in part, by any of these protected characteristics in any employment decision. The Supreme Court has held that even any voluntary affirmative action program is permissible only temporarily and in narrow circumstances. Whether we should enact statutes that command diversity, equity, and inclusion is another question. My answer is no. We should not enact such statutes. My opinion does not arise from a denial that diversity, equity, and inclusion can be good. Racial and ethnic diversity are beautiful and beautifully American, whether in the neighborhood, in the house of worship, or the workplace, and everywhere else. Nor does my opinion arise from a denial that illegal discrimination still happens. When I was at the EEOC, we had a case with evidence that black oil rig workers were forced to work outside in the heat, while white oil rig workers worked inside in the air conditioning. In another case, I saw a videotape of an employer defending himself to the police by saying, "I'm a good employer. I mean, I'm not going to hire Mexicans or blacks or homosexuals, but I'm a good employer." The problems persist. But nonetheless, for two reasons, the law requires and should require only non-discrimination. First, favoring people by identity groups in order to achieve diversity is, by definition, discrimination. DEI encourages and rewards illegal discrimination. An employer cannot discriminate in favor of applicants or employees in one protected group without discriminating against applicants and employees in other protected groups. An employer giving favored treatment to Hispanics is giving less favored treatment to African Americans, Asians, and everybody else. Such a hiring practice may be well-intentioned discrimination, but it is nonetheless discrimination. And when you are on the negative end of it, it hurts. As Chief Justice Roberts said in his Parents Involved opinion, "The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race." We can't stop it if we keep doing it. Recently, some prominent corporations announced they would achieve a certain percentage of increase in black executives and employees over the next 5 years. These sorts of quotas mean that employees outside the categories given preferential treatment will be given inferior treatment. Employers should be on notice. 2 weeks ago, on October 28, a federal jury in North Carolina awarded $10 million to David Duvall, a former executive of Novant Health, after he put on evidence that he was fired because he's a white man and his employer was trying to diversify. Americans believe we have all been created equal and we must be treated as equals under the law. To be sure, we achieve this aspiration most imperfectly. And individuals, aware of the unfairness of life that has visited some in disproportion to others, should serve those most in need. Contribute to causes designed to level the playing field. Volunteer time mentoring, serving, foster parenting, helping in any way possible. Do it early and do it often. Follow a few disadvantaged children all the way through school, helping wherever you can. Because when those children reach the doors of the workplace as applicants and employees, the law requires that they must be treated as equals with all other applicants and employees without discrimination in their favor. To do otherwise would not only be illegal, it would be misguided. Consider the Coca-Cola former general counsel who directed the company's lawyers to staff Coca-Cola's cases with a quota of minority lawyers. It is easy to see how such a requirement is not only illegal, but counterproductive. The minority lawyers who were supposed to be helped by such a requirement are suddenly under pressure to put in large numbers of hours working on Coca-Cola matters when they may prefer doing other work. The second reason the law should require only non-discrimination and not DEI is that law and litigation, by their nature, are exceedingly blunt instruments. Ultimately, the evils and wrongs of the workplace are failures of love. They are, at bottom, spiritual problems that the civil law can imperfectly manage but cannot cure. The best we can do to remedy discrimination is to pass laws making it illegal and then to diligently enforce those laws. A third problem with the current DEI agenda is what it omits. DEI discussions make almost no mention of religion, one of the great protections of our legal system, explicitly protected in Title VII. I don't wish that employers were inquiring into the religion of applicants and employees. However, the omission of religious diversity in the discussion of DEI has troubling congruity with the same omission now being made in employer policies about discrimination. Twice, very recently, I have seen employer discrimination policies that simply excise religion from the list of protected bases. It seems that the current mood, so intent on protecting racial and sexual equity, overlooks the constitutional and statutory protections for religion. Earlier this year, the same administration pushing DEI on the public shut down the religious non-discrimination work group at the EEOC and put its work product down the memory hole. It is not as if religious discrimination is not happening. Employees who are weakened pastors have been terminated from their day jobs because of sermons preached on the weekend. Alaska Airlines invited its employees to comment on the airline's support of the proposed Equality Act and then fired two flight attendants who took their offer and raised religious concerns about the proposed law. Kroger grocery stores fired two longtime religious employees, a cashier and a deli worker, who requested to substitute their own navy blue aprons for store aprons bearing LGBTQ pride emblems. The list of these cases is very long. When it comes to religious diversity, DEI champions fall silent. Much of what is called diversity, equity, or inclusion appears to be an effort to make everyone conform to thinking the way that those in power think. It appears less tolerant and less diverse than old-fashioned non-discrimination. We live in the best country in the world, but even it is populated by and governed by fallen human beings. Some of us hope that when Jesus returns to set up his kingdom, we will see perfect justice and perfect love in the workplace and everywhere else. But in the meantime, we do not live in utopia. Rather, we enact laws that help us approach proximate justice. Non-discrimination and equal opportunity is the best we've got. Even if we could somehow eradicate all discrimination made illegal by our employment statutes, and we could achieve perfectly proportioned diversity, equity, and inclusion without violating any of those laws, we would find that we had still not addressed rampant discrimination based on class, education, intelligence, philosophical beliefs, beauty, body size, and that list stretches on, practically speaking, to infinity. I'm stressing today the inevitable limits of the law, the EEOC, the courts, and the HR departments. If this seems defeatist or despairing, I insist otherwise. Instead, I believe that a futile perfectionism, a demand for perfect equity, would distract us from the great good that we have accomplished and must continue to accomplish by opposing unfair discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, national origin, and disability. Illegal discrimination still exists. I've heard years of employee stories, and I've read the hate speech on the public restroom walls. Nonetheless, Americans have in large part embraced Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream that all people will be judged by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin. The civil rights laws have been successful, not perfectly successful, but enormously successful in resisting and suppressing such discrimination. Let's not start now discriminating in the name of diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Sharon, thank you for those remarks. My pleasure next to introduce Daniel Viau, the Chief Executive Officer of Intelligent Partnerships. Dan brings decades of policy experience specializing in innovative and accessible workforce design, transforming businesses while adding value. He is the immediate past chair of the National Board of Directors for the Association of Latino Professionals for America, the former deputy administrator in the Office of Apprenticeship for the U.S. Department of Labor, and the author of Beyond Green Jobs, Addressing Diversity and Climate Change Solutions. Dan, it's a pleasure to have you today.
Well, first of all, I'm grateful for the opportunity to appear here and chat about DEI and access issues. HR is evolving, and as was just pointed out so eloquently, there's a challenge between the law and what is protected against what the public is demanding. Because the people of America have embraced diversity in a very real way, but corporate environments have not. And so the tension then is, how do we evolve into a space that makes sense? The reality is that what you should probably know about me first is that I'm not a lawyer, so you can use your filter on my words based on that. I am also don't come from the pedigree that's represented in this room, education-wise. I'm just a kid from a neighborhood in LA who worked his way up through the ranks, and I have had the privilege of serving both our government and private corporate environments in evolving the opportunities that they generate, both for businesses and their employees, in a way that's significantly meaningful. And so our lens at Intelligent Partnerships is not one of advocacy. We're not trying to create reparations or get our pound of flesh. Our purview is from what makes business sense. As I shared with the panelists on a previous call, if it don't make money, it don't make sense. And corporate environments are not going to adopt these policies if there's not an interest in the bottom line return on investment and there's not genuine value. And so diversity, equity, and inclusion does make financial sense. Case in point, a few years ago now, State Street Financial spent a lot of money marketing a golden statue that they placed in front of a bull out there on Wall Street. They didn't overnight decide that women needed to be empowered in the marketplace. They didn't overnight discover that the women in their organization were smarter than the men in their organization. What they discovered was that fund performance at a bottom line level that was managed by women were outperforming other funds. That was recently validated by new data that demonstrates that not only are funds managed by women outperforming traditionally managed funds, but they're doing it in double digits. And so the realities of the math in the business space lend themselves to ensure that you have diversity of thought and diversity of experience in your ecosystem in order to remain competitive. Those organizations that decide that they want to hold on to their traditional models will experience the pain, because the demographic realities also demonstrate significant shifts sooner rather than later, right? BLS data shows that Hispanic working age adults between the ages of 18 and 45 make up over 60% of today's U.S. workforce. And when connected to blended marriages, that number shoots up above 80%. And so you have the youngest working demographic, the actual workforce that's available to you, extremely diversified from the historical workforce that has been available in the U.S. and accessible in the normal pools that you fish in. In addition, all indicators point to this same demographic, the Latinos' purchasing power topping $1.3 trillion in the next 24 months. I'm going to let that sink in for a moment. Not in the next decade, but by 2023, all indicators point that the purchasing power of the U.S. Latino will be at $1.3 trillion. That is the most powerful statement in terms of earning power and collective market availability that the U.S. has seen in decades. And yet less than 6% of American marketing dollars by corporate America are being spent in attracting that population. And so if your clients and companies that you represent don't reflect the realities of this evolving market space, you're already in trouble. The opportunity is exponential, as through a reimagined HR model, organizations can also move HR from a fixed cost center to ROI. As the C-suite and stockholders call for inclusive practices, there's a glaring opportunity to reposition HR in order to make it more productive, right? The ability to lower cost factors by casting a wider net is real. And yes, everybody wants the Yale or Harvard grad, depending on which side of the room you're on. But that pedigree is giving way to technological advances and access to information that doesn't necessarily make it necessary for employees to invest $120,000 in their education for a $40,000 a year job, and B, doesn't require companies to own that employment relationship wholeheartedly, right? The other part of the problem, the other side of that coin, is that workers, especially on the lower end of the economic spectrum, workers have figured out that they don't need to give you 30 hours of work to generate the $600 or $800 a week that they would generate in that part-time, no-benefit employment environment. They could earn poverty wages on their own without you. They could drive a car for a couple of days, or go online and work in those environments. And so the business model of corporate America that has driven wages down collectively for an exponential amount of time is now in jeopardy, because, quote unquote, the workforce is not available. No, the workforce is not available at the value that you place on that workforce. So, the reason organizations can't find diverse talent is because they're fishing in the same pond that they've always fished in. And you won't catch different fish in that same space, right? So if your organization is truly interested in diversifying your workforce, you have to expand the spaces that you're looking in. And the public and the C-suite and stockholders are calling for this diversification because it represents them, not because there's a legal obligation or because there's a need that hasn't been met by corporate America to ensure that there's a level playing field. It's because it reflects our actual society and what it looks like and what is emerging in terms of demographics around the country. And so organizations that ignore that will feel that pain exponentially. DEI, when it's deployed on purpose, can be a powerful business advantage. Diversity through of thought and experience translates into fresh approaches and new market exposures, immediately making new markets available. Having people on your team that look and have similar experiences to your paying clients that you're trying to attract makes all the difference in the world. And if you don't believe that, just ask Reebok and their experience with Beyonce. It's a genuine issue that companies are going to continue to face if they don't reflect the dollar that they're trying to pursue. This is not about only doing the right thing. Yes, it's the right thing to do, but it's not just about that. It's a business imperative. Whatever your organization's position is on DEI, if you're going to engage, you have to do it on purpose. Don't just check the box, because that'll also cause you to be crucified in the public space, right? So ensure that engagement is genuine and can be quantified, as stakeholders will hold you accountable. Internal and external expectations are real and have to be taken seriously, or the company culture and the reputation will be exposed to risk. These adjustments or accommodations do not mean that the organization has to lower the bar. It simply should look beyond its historical netcasting when seeking talent and creating meaningful bodies of work that deliberately deliver on their client promise. Now, Title VII may codify all the needed language and regulatory protection, or maybe it doesn't codify it, according to what I just heard, right? But the reality is that the real-world practices of employers who generate multiple ways to design workforces that mirror their historical demographics has led to measurable wage gaps, separation of professional employment trajectories, false ceilings, and a workforce that today counts the highest number of workplace strikes in the last 50 years, today. And so workers have figured out that they don't need your part-time, no-benefit job to earn poverty-level wages. They can do that without your clients. And that reality needs to be considered before one of your clients closes the door on creating work environments that are inclusive, empowering, and generate real income. Or they will go the way of Sears Roebuck and so many other industry icons that cannot read the writing on the wall. That's all I have to say about that.
Dan, thanks for those comments. Finally, Larry James. Larry is the managing partner of the law firm of Crabb, Brown & James in Ohio, a leader in the business, legal, and civic life of Columbus for more than three decades. Larry's practice has included work on behalf of student athletes at Ohio State, and since 2001, serving as the general counsel of the National Fraternal Order of Police. He's also the co-founder of the African American Leadership Academy, and a member of the Board of Trustees at Kenyon College. Larry, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society. Let me give you the street corner, how I see the world and how I got to where I am. My background is I've prosecuted police officers. I've defended police officers. I've administrated for police officers. And now I've been general counsel to the National Fraternal Order of Police since 01. I was also, at one time, the general counsel of the local NAACP and have been the general counsel of the Columbus Urban League now for 15 years. So I am that perfect mutt. And I've seen the world from 360 time and time again. I also, the smartest thing I ever did last week, my wife and I celebrated 32 years of marriage. And people in Central Ohio and somewhere around the country will say that I hit the jackpot. My wife, Donna James, is the new chair of the board of Victoria's Secret as reconstituted. It's an all-women's board. So Donna had served on the prior board for 17 years, and when the issue came to this, as a black woman, she was trying to figure out, was this right, the right thing to do? And I said, number one, are you crazy? And if you love the bacon, don't hate the pig. You know, so embrace it. But so she's been on that, chairing that board since August 1. She's also on Boston Scientific, and Hartford Insurance, and she served on a number of boards. So this issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion, I have pillow talk for 32 years in addition to representing the clients that I represent. And the way I come at this issue, I think we have a failure of leadership. This division we see in America is a failure of leadership. And the idea, I think, about inclusion and whether it makes business sense without hurting someone but helping everyone is the focus I usually approach with my clients. And that is, number one, let's talk about what we're trying to address. You know, if you go to a physician and you have to, you know, articulate what it is that you want that's hurting you, and how do we fix it without adding to that pain? That's the same thing in this field. You know, it's educating leadership, it's educating the workforce, it's training the workforce, and including the workforce to participate so this is not so foreign or so painful. I say, you know, Don and I, dinner conversations are fantastic because we both realize that the older we get, the more successful we get, the more isolated we become, and the more segregated we become. So we have to work very hard at this inclusion thing. And we're both from a family of seven, and you know, we have mixed results in those family of sevens. But what we both have done, 17 years ago, we started the African American Leadership Initiative in Columbus, Ohio. Now we have over 250 graduates of that program. It's become the feeder system of education, not-for-profit, and the private sector. It is incredible. The Columbus Partnership this past year just put in $150,000. And they asked us, would we increase it and double it? Why? Because it was filtering and committing to that issue of diversity and inclusion, both women and men. And I think that's the type of success we're talking about. That's the type of thing we embrace without the controversy. You know, when one of the things we talked about, this wokeness thing, and particularly being a black man and general counsel for the National FOP, I catch hell. And I've caught hell for a long time, including in my household. So, you know, and what I say to people is, when you're looking at the problem to diagnose, that diagnostic issue of the problem is, I say to the world, the union does not hire, it does not fire, it does not train, it does not set the budget, it does not set the policy. But everybody is looking at us as the boogeyman. I catch it from the Federalist Society, I catch it from the Cato Institute, I catch it from Ben and Jerry, and obviously I catch it from the black community. And I say, you know, look, folks, we are in this together, and if we don't come together to try to figure it out and diversify, we are going to create a lot of harm, and down the road, it's going to be very painful to cure our ills. I was given a talk a couple weeks ago, and I said, think about this if you're thinking about diversity in the police department. You're dealing with a zip code with a high crime area that's 98% black. Your seniority program has you only white males to try to address the issue of crime in that zip code. How smart is that? You're just not going to be successful. The other thing I didn't tell you, I was also safety director in Columbus over police and fire, and I had the obligation and responsibility of setting that budget, setting those policies, and trying to address those issues. So what I did is I brought in our command staff and I said, look, folks, this is what I'm after. This is what I need. Can you work with me? Understanding that you had the union contract. And as a result of being safety director is the reason I became general counsel for the National FOP. Do good, do not do harm. The one thing that always puzzles me is this issue of affirmative action and how it became a hot button issue. And I'm finishing my 11th year on the Board of Trustees of Kenyon College. I chaired the admission committee. I think if you look around the country and you look at the gender gap on GPAs and test scores, women are outperforming men like night and day. If we had a meritocracy, our colleges would begin to go 40, 50, 60, 70 cent women. So I remember being chairman of the board, and particularly where you're doing, where you have colleges and universities, that you need the full pay student. You need the full pay student to generate that money for academic aid. So you were limited, no matter how talented those students were of color or poverty. If you met that goal that you hit your percent of revenue, it could only be spread so far. And I remember saying, I said, my God, the affirmative action baby is the white male. And we need boy toys in order to be competitive so that we keep diversity on the gender side of it. Then we look at the legacy. I can tell you unequivocally at that college, we did not accept any student who was not qualified to perform. We passed over a lot of students of color because we didn't have the money to give them to compete. And I remember as I came in and I did this example of admissions, and people were shocked and said, oh my God, I had no idea. Ladies and gentlemen, what I challenge you to do is really diversify your association. Because I think, again, as I said, as we grow and we are limited as to our exposure and our conversation, it's going to be so much more difficult to get it and set policy. One of the things I do with a lot of our clients is I sit down, we put those programs together, and we say, here's our policy. Here's how we're going to diversify. We're going to help, and we're not going to harm. And that becomes your skill set and your test. Because in litigation, at the end of the day, the damage is already done. You're just trying to figure out who's going to get the greatest degree of pain. But if you're building that house, if you're building that policy, you will understand. I remember when I came home and I told my wife I was going to become the general counsel of the national FOP, she said, have you lost your mind? I said, we've got to have someone in the room. We've got to participate. And it's not going to be easy. It's going to be painful. But I think the people that we interact with and our law firm interacts with understand what that means. One of the other things as a managing partner I do on the firm, on our charitable giving, we demand everybody to participate, to have skin in the game. You do not come to me and say, I want to make a $10,000 contribution here if you don't participate. You've got to participate, and you got to stay involved. The last thing I'll say, and the perfect example of inclusion, think about our music industry. Think about our film industry, our entertainment industry. Will Haygood just came out of a book, just produced a book called Colorization, and we did the national rollout of that book in Columbus, Ohio, and we say everyone goes to the movies. Think about when they came out with Gone with the Wind, Birth of a Nation. Now, I understand that the law may say, well, you can't give preference. You damn sure you can, and you do give preference. We all do, and it's based on our personal preference. The question is, have we expanded our recipe, our taste bud, our vision to be inclusive? And I think what you'll find and challenge, you will become so much more enriched. It has enriched my wife's life, my life, and my family life. Thank you very much.
I want to thank all the participants for those opening remarks and continue on with some discussion. One of the things that, Larry, you sort of raised powerfully as a call to action is that we have to figure this out. And I wonder if we could start by talking about what the it is in that challenge do we have a consistent standard for what is normally referred to as DEI? What is it? Where does it come from? And then, if we want, we could talk about where it might be codified. I know this is something that both Sharon and Dan had thoughts on as well, so I'd open up to anyone who has a thought.
Well, I think, again, when you're establishing policy, I'll tell you, the Hoya Fair Plan is a private public insurance company, and at one point in time, we were looking at redlining, and the administration came to me and said, how are we going to structure these policies? How are we going to train the agents that sell our product to understand that these folks need coverage? So we sat down and we looked at the financial portfolio, if you will, and by portfolio I meant that, you know, what you qualified for, what your financial scores were, and we retooled that. There, and we've seen that historically where folks have looked at where there's been disparate impact on a certain constituency, whether that's redlining or overcharging and loans and things of that sort. We just need to do an audit and say, is it real that these policies are adversely discriminating against a certain group of people? And if it is, like medicine, you find the solution. You find the solution without having harm. I was safety director when we had the dual lists of women and blacks on fire and police because it had been so bad for so many years. And then it ran its course, and those dual lists were terminated. But I can tell you, if you live in this space, if you associate with people whose job it is to try to figure out what these policies are, they won't be so repugnant.
Sharon, how would you respond? Do you see this as something that remedies past harms, or do you see a broader mission in modern DEA?
What Mr. James just discussed in terms of the dual lists for women and for minorities at some point for the police is a good example of how affirmative action can sometimes be done legally. The court has allowed for temporary measures when you are addressing past discrimination that you can prove it's apparent, it's kind of obvious that people just haven't been hiring women or haven't been hiring minorities for a long period of time. If an employer is able to show these things and draw up and explain the past discrimination that's happened, they may be able to temporarily come up with some affirmative action that passes muster. But that's not what's being talked about in DEI now in the workplace. No, I'm sure it's a big world. I'm sure somebody's doing something everywhere. But the situations I hear about are not situations where anybody is going out and trying to show that we had past discriminatory policies, at least not in the recent past, that women or minorities were forbidden to work in these organizations. And they're not trying to do it temporarily. They're saying, let's come up with a way to promote women and minorities at the expense of other people in the workplace. And that's the thing that the law simply doesn't allow. I think that there are some good suggestions. I did a lot of reading getting ready for this panel just on diversity, equity, and inclusion online, just seeing what people said about it. And I found that the comments kind of fell in three categories. The first category was good comments people made. But they were nothing new. They're best practices that we've heard forever. Diversify where you advertise, where you seek applications from. Go to historically black colleges. Go to places that you might not have advertised in the past and advertise there too. That's a good thing to expand the breadth of your advertisement. Have a blind review of applications. That's a good idea too. Don't do the touch people on the shoulder promotions, but make people apply so you make sure that you're considering everybody. All these things are good suggestions. And then there was what I jokingly was referring to as the word salad things that talked about in DEI, where I just read it and couldn't figure out what in the world they were saying, and there was a whole bunch of that I read. And then there were just the bad suggestions, just the illegal suggestions. You know, employers need to come up with particular programs and particular benefits for their minority candidates. The law just doesn't allow this. It doesn't work. And if you go back and try to do that, you're going to have to undo. You're going to have changes to the Constitution, which provides for equality. You're going to certainly have to have a change to Title VII, which doesn't permit race discrimination. So I think people have got to think about ways to do this that are not illegal. I do think one thing to think about is the BFOQ, the bona fide occupational qualification. One thing that Mr. Viao was saying is that, you know, you're going to miss the boat if you don't try to direct some of your employees to figuring out what the Latino community wants or what the Black community wants. That's fine. You can hire people for the purpose of looking at these different marketplaces and figuring out what these different marketplaces want. But then you're going to have to be specific in the way you define the job, what the purpose of the job is. And I think you could pass a BFOQ test to say, we want the minorities in these positions because that's what their purpose is here.
So I agree with you, Sharon, that the law doesn't allow for the establishment of protocols the way that some people are asking them for. But the interpretation of the law has allowed corporations to do it silently, to create disparate mechanisms and structures that limit the ability to access to work, that limit the supply chain to those that they're comfortable with. And so there's a very, and the fact that they have resources, see, there's a bottom, and I think this is what you were getting to earlier, Paul. The law assumes a level playing field, that everybody is starting at the same starting line, that everybody has a genuine access to the playing field and is equipped the same way to maneuver that space. Let me tell you that I do not come from a poor family. I come from a middle-class working family. I did attend in my junior and senior year some private schools, but they were not private academies that led me to spaces where I could get letters of endorsements from senators and move me into the type of academic environments that would have been a much more powerful place. Had that been accessible for me, I would have been a terrible monster would be significantly more better positioned than I am today. Why? Because that arsenal of tools that comes from that space and from that access at the early stages of the race makes all the difference. The fact that education is funded through home ownership taxes, and that populations are coupled together on the east side looking one way and the west side looking another way, and the value that's generated from those property taxes funds education at different levels immediately creates a disparate model. And so, yeah, I'm smart. I'm real smart, but I would be a lot smarter had I been in an environment or environments that really empowered me and really supported me in a way that was meaningful. Now, this is not a personal, whining session. It's just a reality. It's a reality. The leading generator of new small businesses are Latinas in the U.S. That's the demographic reality. The math isn't going to lie. 80% of American marriages are blended, whether it's African American, Asian American, or Latino American. The majority of U.S. Latinos are born here in the United States. They're not foreigners that are coming to take your jobs. They're U.S. citizens that are working here and have lived here for generations. My wife is 8 generations in as a Latina here. Right? So we've been around for a long, long time, but we didn't start at the same place. Now, advocates get mad at me too, because I say things like, hey, it's not about creating a new disparate system. It's about leveling the playing field and making sure that everybody has access. In this moment, in this time, on this project, in this company, everybody plays this at the same level, can compete at the same level. Because white people have to work too. And so the fear that is being stirred up in white America, that America has changed and is changing, it's real. It has changed. And it will continue to change. And so that economic separation that already exists, that is genuine, it has begun to brew discontent. And for those folks that are, I've heard all day long about originalists and the original language. We forget that for the first 100 years, that original language was not influenced by people of color at all. We didn't have any opportunity to give any input to that established language that has formulated the prison system, the education system, and all other systems, including corporate environments and corporate law in the US. So the fact that we didn't get to create any of the rules but have to play by them, and folks are 150, 100 years ahead of us in terms of interpreting them, and now they're getting their feelings hurt because we're figuring it out, and the global competitive landscape has emerged in the technical environment, in the technology space, that allows us to compete for real. Makes you nervous, and you should be.
Couple things. Nationwide Insurance Company, I think most of you are very familiar with. And when I talked about my experience in working with some of the companies, if you look at Nationwide today, I'm going to brag on my wife again. They give the Donna A. James Award at Nationwide.
Love it.
And after Donna, and you look at corporate Nationwide today, it's like night and day. I don't know if you want to call it affirmative action, whatever you want to call it. They figured it out. And when they decided to reconstitute that board of Victoria's Secret to go with 7 women and no men, that was a discretion. The last example was the Ohio Water Development Authority in Ohio. And before Warren Tyler, a real good friend of mine, became chairman of that organization, there were no black investment bankers. There were no black lawyers. It had been around for 35 years. It went from 0 black folks participating to about 30%. And the performance improved. There are absolute discretionary positions that companies have that have nothing to do with affirmative action, diversity, inclusion. They just make up their mind, this is what we want our workforce to look at. And we're going to get the best, and we're going to get the brightest. And so I want to say to you, look at the policies that are working that never see the courthouse, that never see the challenge. Folks, it's going on. Don't get caught up in the technical legal jargon. I understand that. But again, I'm going to go back to where I started. This is about leadership.
May I?
Please.
It's interesting to me. I know my perspective is just my own. It's small. But in my experience, the employers that I have represented, they are embracing diversity. People are so happy to have diverse people. And the boards that I've been on the employers that I'm representing, I just haven't seen anybody trying to keep minorities out of the workplace, trying to suppress women in the workplace. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. Of course, I've admitted it still happens. But I don't think that is the norm. And I want to address, in response to Mr. Viao saying that he grew up in a middle-class family, so did I. I grew up in a middle-class family in a town of 2,000 people, New Buffalo, Michigan, just an hour from Chicago. I didn't know race discrimination. I can't pretend like I know what life felt like for the black people in my town. But we had quite a few black families, many of whom had moved from Chicago to New Buffalo. I said quite a few, but that's not accurate. There weren't very many, but I mean, the basketball team was all black starters on the basketball team. So there were at least that many The teachers, the families, everybody taught us. We are one. We are unified. The color of our skin doesn't matter. And I just believed them. And I thought everybody thought that. And I never saw, it was all about unity as Americans and unity as Michiganders and unity as New Buffalo people. Of course, I was just a child. I was only 6 years old when the Civil Rights Act was passed. But I saw that, and I still look back on that, as the lunchrooms were integrated. When my kids were going to high school in Arlington, Virginia, and I was over there in the lunchrooms, I noticed more segregation. But when I was a kid, I didn't see segregation. And I think this spirit of unity is important. And I am seeing now, with some of this DEI agenda, a spirit of division. And it is not good. It is not a good spirit. We need to reject the spirit of division and embrace the spirit of unity. We are on the same team. We need to be all trying to help to pull each other up. And I think that's what most people are doing. We need to give each other credit for that. And I agree. We're in this together, and we need to look for ways to solve problems. But we need to do it in a way that doesn't violate the law.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And I work with clients that are very corporate clients, large corporations that you would recognize their names. I agree with you that there doesn't seem to be an intent of separating by race or keeping people down. But when you look at the numbers, the reality of the numbers is that people of color, others, make up middle management and below versus executive level positions. The number of board seats for Latina women in the U.S. is less than 2%. It's a reality. I think the figure for African Americans is somewhere around 3.5%. And so states have tried to intervene and regulate this, like California. Not sure that that's the right practice, right? I don't necessarily agree that we need to force people to do this. I think business will figure out that it makes sense, financial sense, to diversify the way your organizations operate. And so from my perspective, I agree with you. We're all in this together. It's just that some of us don't get to ride on the same bus that others do. And that's the real issue. And until everybody recognizes it and begins to work collaboratively to change that dynamic, I think that there's quite a bit of opportunity to move.
This idea of collaboration and working together has come up a couple of times now. And so I'm curious whether, do you see this as something appropriate for state action, for government involvement, or is it something that would benefit more from local, non-governmental solutions? In other words, do you see this as a project that is largely something about changing law, or rather changing the way people act with one another so that the law may ultimately be less of a concern?
I can tell you from we call it the Columbus Way, and I talked about the African American Leadership Academy and investing in your future. The corporate community has indicated without hesitancy, this is where we want to be. We want to be the leading city in the country that embraces everyone and welcomes everyone. I mean, this world that people seem to suggest that we're forcing these issues down the door, I don't see it. And believe you me, I'm a Republican, I represent the cops, you know, I catch hell. So we've got to produce, and we've got to produce long-term sustainable things. I've earned those stripes, I think my wife and I both, in this space. We say unapologetically, if you want us to be in that black space, we'll embrace it. We write checks, challenge everyone, we participate, we include everyone without exception. when the gay initiative came for benefits, Donna was the HR person, my wife was the HR person at Nationwide. It was one of the first in the country. Collaboration to inclusion. If your team believes in this, I guarantee you, you'll have one of those dinners like we just had with our law firm for the end of the year where I'm passing out checks and people going, why didn't we do this sooner?
On the LGBTQ issue, if you want to know what it feels like to feel like an outsider who is not embraced, be a religious person who doesn't want to cause any harm to any LGBTQ person, who does not want that LGBTQ person to be discriminated against in the secular workplace, but simply cannot say, I celebrate this, because that person's religion does not permit them to celebrate it. Even if they don't ever come out and actively say that, they're going to be in training programs where they are forced to say these things. They're going to take training exercises where you have to complete the entire exercise to keep your job, but if you won't say something that violates your religious beliefs on question three, you can't get to question four. I know situations where people have had pay docked, where people have been fired from their jobs. I mean, you cannot imagine. The new discrimination that is going on, that is rampant, is against religious people. And I don't want to be whining on behalf of religious people, but anybody who doesn't know this needs to wake up to it. People are losing their jobs. I am getting calls about this and hearing about it right and left. So the idea that everybody wants to embrace everybody and we don't know anybody who is not embraced, then you just need to meet a few more people. Because I'm telling you, this is going on.
Yeah. Let me respond to that. I want to respond to that. Because I can tell you, every movement without exception has had its conflicts and its crossing the roads. And I agree with you. You know, two of the most difficult discussions we have today is the vaccination and abortion. And clearly on abortion, that cuts on the religious thing. But that doesn't mean we don't try and we don't work through it. It's not going to be easy. I've said to you, this challenge is painful. This is about leadership. The head of Nationwide, when we started making the moves and we made, when my wife made the thing on inclusion on the gay issue, the head of Nationwide was a Mormon. Diamond McPherson, love him dearly. I remember sitting down talking about this issue, and he says, how do we bridge this gap? I know people in the religious community are going to fight it, but we need your help. And it's going to take time. And if that discrimination occurs, we don't have all the answers as we sit. But if you don't embrace it, you don't get into the storm, you're not going to find smooth sailing.
Yeah, I think the religious exemption is a legitimate beef, and it needs to be explored, and it needs to be evaluated, and every organization is going to review, you know, whatever their practices are. But in terms of the original question that Paul asked, should it be legislated or regulated? There's plenty of rules and laws and regulations in place all over the country to do this. What we don't have is compliance at every level. The compliance structures in this country are designed to be reactive, to be responsive to complaints instead of being proactive and ensuring that organizations are doing what the law requires them to do. You don't hear about the judgments that you described until somebody actually raises the complaint. And there is no design structure, and there's no investment by government in actually ensuring that organizations are performing and delivering on the criteria that the law has laid out. And until we address compliance in a real way, actors are going to do what they do.
If I may just respond briefly to that, you know, you said that we don't hear about this until someone raises the complaint. But I want to note that we don't hear about it even after people raise the complaint. You don't hear about it in the media. You don't hear about it from the EEOC. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which has done such a great job working to defeat all sorts of discrimination. A great bunch of attorneys doing a great job on a lot of things. They have completely dropped the ball on this. They're willing to bring religious discrimination claims for a few very narrow categories of cases. If you need a Sabbath day off, or if you need to pray at a certain time of day, or if you need to wear a headdress, or certain kinds of things like that. But the employees who are discriminated against because of their religious beliefs related to abortion or human sexuality, the EEOC has never brought those cases ever. I asked people, bring me anything, show me an example, contradict what I'm saying here, and nobody brought it to me and showed me. The first case that I know is this Kroger case that was brought when I was at the EEOC, and I got a lot of flack for that. And I'm pointing this out because this is our government. If we really want to protect everybody, then we have to protect everybody. And right now, for reasons I don't completely understand, we have decided certain people are worthy of protection and other people aren't worthy of protection. It's a kind of puritanism that says you people are wearing the letter A over here and you people are the good people. This is not the way it should be done. We are a pluralistic society. We all know this. We have to be able to put up with it and tolerate people who disagree with us. And I know it's a big world, like I said, and there's a lot of different people who would do different things. But the religious people that I know have no intention of discriminating against LGBTQ people in the secular workplace. They will work shoulder to shoulder with people. They will embrace them. They will be friends with them. They simply cannot violate their religious beliefs and what they say. And as I see it, this is the big discrimination that's happening right now that's going not talked about.
As we continue the conversation, we want to get everyone involved. There are microphones for questions, and we'd be happy to direct those to the panel. In the meantime, while we're sort of getting set up for that, just one last question. Where do you see other practices changing as a result of these kinds of initiatives? We talked a little bit about so-called legacy preferences, the idea that corporations and institutions have typically looked to the same narrow set of criteria, consistent with the law, but perhaps not consistent with best practices. Is that one easy avenue for improvement that we think is getting under-addressed in the workspace?
So are you talking about legacy in colleges or?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's, I think Smith, or I can't remember, one of the colleges just announced a week ago that they were terminating the legacy preference. I just think, first of all, thank you for being here. Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it. And I say it time and time again, if we can't sit on these panels, if we can't have this dialogue, whatever the pain of our discussions, we can work through and find a solution. And I agree with you. The religious one is tough. I mean, my wife said the other day, if I had known that preacher that married us had these ideas, he wouldn't have been marrying us. But those are the type of convictions. I think they have to be pretty close to principle and absolute.
We'll take your questions. That next panel, we're definitely bringing Larry's wife. Does everyone agree with that? No question. No question.
Sounds amazing.
Hey, Pepper Crutcher, I'm the chairman of the practice group. First of all, I want to say I promise you that that light back there that went out that put Daniel and Larry in the dark, leaving Sharon and Judge Mady in the light, was totally accidental. They tried to fix it the best they can. I promise you it was not programmed. I got down on my hands and knees back there and tried to find the plug myself. So a response to Sharon and a question for Daniel and Larry. Unlike you, Sharon, I grew up in the very segregated South. I was actually there for the James Meredith thing at Ole Miss. And my first memory of this whole issue was I hung out in the kitchen with Georgia Isaiah and Willie B. Tankersley and all the rest, people I loved. And my first notice of something was very wrong was when I noticed that they talked to each other in one tone of voice, one mannerism, and when they talked to white adults, they talked in a totally different tone of voice, different mannerism, chose their words carefully. I didn't understand what was wrong, but I knew something was very wrong with that situation. I'm now seeing young white men in the workplace do the very same thing. They speak to each other in one pattern, and when they talk to anybody in supervision, they're acting like they're somebody else. I think there's something very wrong there, and it can't lead to a good place. Daniel, Larry, does that worry you at all?
Well, you know, when I was, if I could digress a minute, when we were going out to Kansas City for the FOP to get them recognized, and I told our FOP leadership that happened to be all white, I said, look, there's a conversation that black folks have when white folks are in the room. There's another one we have when you ain't in the room. And so there may become that time that I ask you to leave. You know, why are all the black kids eating in the cafeteria sitting together? So yes, but again, I think this is about our leadership. We have become, and I agree that we've become somewhat of a canceling out certain cultures, and we've become politically correct that if you say the wrong thing, I'm gonna take your head off. Or I'm worried about if I say something, I'm gonna be fired. But again, that leadership thing about the supervisors, the executives, you know, we've got to push them to be better and address that issue.
Yeah, I will just emphasize, it's not about creating another disparate system. And the American Latino has an opportunity as the power shifts and they come into leadership roles. They have a tremendous honor and responsibility on how they will lead once the numbers are there. Are we going to learn from the history and the practices of our predecessors and make it equitable for everyone and treat everybody in a way that's meaningful? Or are we going to continue this legacy that exists in this nation of creating opportunity for those that look and reflect our own principles? So it's a very interesting time for this country. I know there's more questions, so I'll stop.
Hi, I'm Andrea Lucas, and I'm a commissioner on the EEOC. I'd like to say that not all of the EEOC is against religious discrimination.
Fair point.
I will speak up on that point. But on race discrimination issues in DEI, I did want to say that to some degree we're talking past each other on the panel about exactly what kind of DEI initiative we're talking about. There's a variety, as Sharon mentioned. I'm particularly interested in DEI-related trainings, though, and wanted to get the panel's thought on that. There's a lot of research that indicates that many DEI trainings actually create racial polarization and don't actually produce the business results that people want. So when we're talking about inclusion practices, perhaps there is a lot of business data that supports a diverse workforce might produce better results. But in terms of a lot of, I think you have some people who are making quite a lot of money on the DEI industrial complex. And it's not actually the leadership that Larry's been talking about. I think sometimes people do too little. They satisfy thoughts about corporate compliance by passing this or that DEI training, and then they do nothing. Or they engage in overt racial discrimination and hiring, and then they don't care about retention of workers. So I do wonder that some of this is really less about DEI training and more fixed by leadership, as Larry mentioned, and actually looking at the workplace culture that you have. Do you have a healthy workforce?
Right.
And that cuts across race and cuts into class and cuts into working conditions of employees. You're right, Daniel, that if you aren't paying people a living wage, maybe they don't want to work for you. So I'd like, you know, I think people should think about that. I'm interested in your thoughts. Are some of these corporations doing too little? They're checking the box to do some training, or they're engaging in some hiring discrimination on the front end, and then they're leaving their diverse employees to the wolves, along with everyone else, to an unhealthy workplace, and then wondering why they find themselves not retaining women, not retaining others. Well, maybe it's the culture of your workplace.
Yeah, I have very clear and direct thinking on DEI training. A lot of it is designed to expose old wounds and not solution-based, and I have a problem with that. The fact that I'm rubbing your face in 200 years of bad treatment is not helpful. Again, I would say the corporate leadership, government leadership needs to focus on where we go from here. Have there been wrongs in the past, and should somebody address that? I'll let other people debate that. Where is this country going from this space forward? Because we're in a global competitive marketplace where your mom and pop shop in rural Ohio or in Arkansas, where I just left a bunch of business leaders, wherever they are, they're competing with businesses around the world. It's no longer just competing in their own communities. And so your ability to interact in a much broader marketplace now is saturated, and adding this layer of garbage about trying to fix something that you had no control over, to me, doesn't make sense. To me, if you're a business leader today, I would encourage you, not to focus on the wrongs that have occurred in the past. If you need to address issues in your organization, you should address them. But the real game is on what happens on a going forward basis. How do you make it fair for everybody? Everybody. And I married a preacher's kid, so I do understand the religious issue very clearly as well. But the opportunity around training is really about helping people learn about each other. You know, I'm gonna digress for just a moment, if you'll allow me. My family's from Ecuador, South America. My parents came here in 1963. My mother was a chief of staff for a university professor who was about to launch a campaign to become the president of Ecuador, and did eventually win that presidency. She was well-educated, came here because of her accent, even though she spoke English, because of her accent, was given a back office job and told not to speak with clients at a very well-known national American banking institution that all of you would recognize. In 1963, she was told that that was a firing offense if she interacted with her clients, with their clients. And so that's where my parents started. My father came here as an electrician and was fired on the first day because he didn't know the names of the material and the tools in English. And so from that early beginning, they built a legacy that allowed me to work from kind of a middle class on-ramp. And so I've always been the odd man out, because in LA in the 70s, when I was growing up as a kid, there was black people, there was white people, and there were Mexicans. There was not a big thriving Ecuadorian community that you could rely on. And so my role as a kid, I learned to speak English in the streets of my neighborhood, helping other kids play with each other, convincing other kids that the other person of different background was cool and they could have fun with them. And I've done that all my life, and I find myself, ironically, in a business that does the same thing, helping facilitate conversations. And that's what training should do. Facilitate a discussion so that people from diverse backgrounds can get some insight on other people's histories, other people's beliefs, other people's knowledge base, other people's experience, and then coordinate how to move forward together so that there's value for everyone. If everyone doesn't win, no one wins.
Go to the back of the room.
Yes, thank you. Will Trackman from Mountain States Legal Foundation out in Colorado. This question is for Mr. Vallejo and Mr. James. Do either of your organizations or the organizations you work with use race as a factor when hiring or promoting employees?
We do not exclude Anglos, if that's what you're asking. But what we focus on is giving people an opportunity that normally would not be looked at, get a second look. So I'll give you a prime example. A few years ago, in our growth, we were introduced to a young lady who was involved in a training program for disadvantaged young people, had experience with various government systems, and was very bright when I spoke to her. What I look for when I'm hiring people, I'm looking for people that are teachable, people that will actually show up to work, that won't embarrass me when I bring them into a client room. I don't need them to be technically capable because, and we can have a whole other discussion about how you're paying top dollar for candidates that that you're gonna teach for the first 18 months of their employment on your own internal systems anyway. But I don't need them to have the technical capacity. I need them to have the ability to learn and to deliver the outcomes that my company needs them to deliver. And so we invested in this young person, gave her an opportunity, and today she leads a team and leads teams on some of our highest dollar value projects. She would have never gotten that opportunity had her application been screened, I would challenge to say, in 90% of other corporate environments.
The answer is yes in two very specific situations. I'm a lawyer. I represent clients, corporations, obviously cops. So one of the areas, as I started out talking about, in those areas where it is a large percentage, if not completely black, and we have to do an investigation, we're going to need some black folks in order to address that issue. The other area that I suggest to clients and work with him about race is at the college level, where they've had no black hirees forever and ever and ever. And so they're trying to say to parents, to students, why should you come to our college or university when you have no one that looks like us and you're losing all those top minority students? Those are the two areas, and we have been very successful in that, and they haven't been challenged.
My turn? Okay, Tammy McCutcheon, retired. I guess this is for all of you, but Sharon, I really identified with what your comments was. We have the old stuff that everybody's still doing for, we didn't used to call it DEI, but the recruitment, the job fairs, the advertising. And then we have this, the case you mentioned, Novant Health, which I think is a very telling case, where you have a white executive being fired so he could be replaced by minorities and women in order to meet corporate goals. By the way, I once told a client like 15 years ago that they shouldn't be basing their bonus calculations on hiring quotas. They told me, oh yeah, we know, but we don't care because we'd rather have the story be $10 million verdict because of reverse discrimination, right? So they're like, so my question for all of you, there's got to be something in between what we've been doing for 30 years versus these hiring quotas. You know, these, you're going to be fired or you're not going to get your bonus because you've failed to meet quotas for hiring women and minorities. And then, of course, we have, you know, states like California that are actually mandating proportions on boards of females. Where is the leadership and where is the solution? There's got to be an in-between between the same old, and these illegal practices that corporations are increasingly under pressure to do despite the fact that they're blatantly illegal.
Well, let me tell you this. Sorry, go ahead.
I think it's partly, and I don't know the answer, of course. I don't know the answer to all of it. But I do think when you have individuals on an individual basis picking out some talent and seeing a minority person, for instance, or if women are underrepresented, a woman, and saying, I see something there. I'm going to develop that in that person. Doing that, I mean, I think everybody should be looking for people to help develop. I think that's great. But I think it has to be done in a way that doesn't violate the law. And it can't be done by the employer saying, we're going to give special training to certain people, but we're not, to minorities, but we're not going to allow the other people to get it. We're going to permit the women to get this training, but we're not going to permit the men to get this training. That's just not going to work. I think that the solution, I mean, I also think that part of the solution is supposed to be things like Head Start, helping disadvantaged children from the very beginning. We have those programs. Maybe we need more programs. I'm not against those. In fact, I'm in favor of those programs. Somebody should think them up and do them. But we've got to get those programs in place and be helping people as they're growing up so that by the time they get to the workplace, they can make it without discrimination.
I would say look at a company like Nationwide. I think they figured it out. And as a result of what they've done, it has become the magnet for black folks and women to want to work at that company. It's amazing. I am an affirmative action baby, okay, from college on, and I think it was a good investment by everyone. But the most huge affirmative action baby that I am is the general counsel of the National FOP, because the president came, and I have some skills, let me, you know. So it wasn't a big risk, but I think he felt, the way it happened, the president, I had a Supreme Court justice said, there's this individual running for president of the National FOP, will you support him? I wrote a check for $1,000, and he gave it to him, and so the president wanted to come over and have a conversation, say thank you. That five-minute thank you turned into a two-hour battle about black folks and cops. And he's, you know, and so 2 weeks later, he calls me, he says, can I stop by and see you? I said, sure. He says, listen, I'm unopposed. I want you to be my general counsel. And I am so happy you're black on top of it. And the rest is history.
I would just add that HR creates false barriers for itself. And part of the reason that this challenge exists in corporate America is because of, you know, every company says we will only hire the highest quality people, and therefore, you know, why does a customer service clerk have to have an MBA? Right? Because we only hire the best, the most overqualified people, right? And then their trajectory only gets them to middle management. These expectations, and I just said that to SHRM leadership in a big conference. So, you know, human resource managers don't respond well to you telling them that there's other alternatives, there's other pathways on how to move people into employment systems that don't violate the law and that actually create opportunity and value in a way that's significant and meaningful. And so you have to be creative. You don't have to exclude white people. We hire white people on our staff. There's Anglos and men and women and LGBT and everybody else. We're a unicorn, I think. But we are a Latina-owned, wholly Latino-owned business. And so we do have that sensitivity that creating opportunity is in our DNA as a company. And until you embrace that in your leadership circles, the idea that everyone can contribute, you won't see the kind of results that are really productive to your bottom line.
You make a very good point. One thing that employers can do is really take a close look at job descriptions and make sure there aren't requirements on their job qualifications that aren't really needed for the job. I've seen so many job descriptions that require a college degree where no college degree should be necessary for that job. And that's one of the things that we can do right away is say we're going to be willing to hire people without college degrees because this job doesn't need a college degree. We're forcing everybody through this college system. And we shouldn't be doing that. So maybe that could make a difference for minorities.
Best kept secret. Yes, please. The best kept secret in the federal government is the registered apprenticeship system. The utilization of apprenticeship modeling to help equip employees as they enter new career trajectories is powerful. And you can get tax credits depending on the space, on the state that you're working in. Lots of ways to bring people into your system.
We're right up against the clock, but I think we can squeeze in one last question.
Thank you very much for sharing all these practical ideas. My name is Cenge, and I come from Hungary. I study HR management, and I'm here since the end of August to learn about policymaking in the US. So I just faced this problem back home in Hungary that oftentimes the big firms actually like positively discriminate the people that they are about to hire because they are visibly different than average white person. So they can, you know, easily marketing themselves as an inclusive or a diverse company. And there's been conversation about that in among my folks back home. So I just wanted you, if you could give your point on how the US professionals deal with this problem or if you have this at all.
Maybe I can conclude. In 1981, I was working for the city attorney's office, and I wanted to apply to Crabb, Brown, James. It was Crabb, Brown, Jones, Potts, and Schmidt at that time. And they were strongly vacillating over whether they were going to hire their first black guy. So one of the associates and I staged this thing where I got a job interview and an offer within 10 days from the highest blue blood law firm in the city and went back to them. At that point, I was making $31.5 with the city. The blue blood law firm offered me $39.5. I took the job with Crabb Brown for $22.5. They were not ready, willing to hire the black guy, but for that price, they said, you know, whatever. I say that because those are the realities. And if you look at the law field and the change over the last 20 years on the gender women, it's like night and day.
There's nothing more powerful than the image of a politician standing next to an African-American woman, a Chinese-American woman, a Latina, that's holding a hard hat and the keys to her first home because of a policy piece that they effectuated and allowed them to move into a high dollar value career. The storytelling is part of the journey. And it's part of the price of admission, right? It's a fair trade. It's a fair trade.
As always, the best conversations are the ones that conclude too early. So please do continue this conversation going all week. I want to thank Larry, Dan, Sharon for your exceptional remarks and participation, and for all of you for joining us today. We look forward to seeing you during the rest of the convention this week. Thank you again for spending the time with us.